This is Car Expert.
Trying to get to a meeting in Philadelphia randomly, and the only car in the lot was either a Mustang convertible or a 20-seater bus.
There were a lot of pretty annoyed customers that were desperately trying to give Hyundai $75,000 who can't. This is a car that's sort of a victim of its own success.
This is a game changer even for diehard Land Cruiser owners.
Hello, it's Mandy Turner here, and Mike Costello is joining me this week.
Hello, Mandy.
And James Wong.
Hey, team.
So some more really big car expert news this week, Moco lobbed. And it appears that we've got a bit of a connection with the TV station.
Yeah, so some great news went out, and I'll save the sort of top-level corporate announcements for the exec team and the founders, but we did a partnership this week that went out and was announced by Seven West Media, better known as Channel 7 or the 7 Network. And it's basically a deal that will see our content expand across 7's broadcast, digital and print platforms. So it's part of a wider arrangement. And this is a deal, you know, Channel 7 or the 7 Network has just done deals with the likes of Cricket Australia and Supercars. So, you know, we're really getting involved with it, with an organisation with tremendous, you know, reach and scope and scale. And it's really exciting. We're only 18 months into this journey as a business, and to already be talking with and dealing with organisations of, you know, the size and prowess of Seven West is really fantastic. So it gave everyone on the team a real jolt, I think, to see that this week.
I reckon. I'm also assuming too that Paul Marrick, I'm assuming, is going to be the one to be the spokesperson for anything car news related for Channel 7 News.
I certainly that would definitely tick Paul's boxes, I reckon. but I reckon he'd do a ripping job of that. But look, it'll give us so much more reach. You know, it'll expose all of our content to a wider audience, and it works for everybody. So it's tremendously exciting. And if the great Paulie Marich gets to do a bit more TV time, I'm sure he won't complain.
As he does, he's got a great face for TV. So yeah, he'll love it. It's been another big week, or day, I should say, with cars having new spy picks being released today, Moco.
Yeah, so I don't know. I try to pick out themes in the average day, and we're putting out so much news at the moment. But one of the things I noticed was it was a great day for spy picks. Sometimes spy picks are pretty boring, you know. It's the next generation Volkswagen Passat, you know, exciting times. But today we saw late stage, you know, lightly disguised teaser images or spied images just before launch of the Ford Ranger next generation for 2022, the brand new BMW M3 Touring, the wagon version of the M3 with glowing hot front brake rotors, so you know they're giving it hell around the Nürburgring. And then the Mercedes-Benz EQE SUV was also spied, which is that company's new ground-up electric-only SUV, competitor to the BMW iX and Audi e-tron. So not all the time when we see three or four heavily disguised camo cars on the site is it necessarily the most exciting thing, but I think in this instance, some really cool metal coming down the pipeline, which is great to see.
Yeah. Have we got is Australia still involved with the Ranger with this new one?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, ground up. This is an Aussie program, go to work. In fact, I don't know why I'm talking. Wong is the Ford man. Tell us more, Wong.
Well, you know, I did work there for a little while, and there's probably a lot of details that I can't actually say, but let's just say that, you know, Australia is a key market for Ranger, not just from a selling perspective, but also from a development point of view. And it's the hub for, you know, Ranger's a global model. It covers so many different markets. You've got it in Europe, you've got it in the US, you've got it across the Middle East and Southeast Asia. It's a really, really important car, and potentially for most global model. So it's a huge deal for them. And I think that's why it's not just a big deal here because it sells well. It's a big deal here because it's such a big part of their local operation. So it's a really exciting time. And obviously we'll also see the next Volkswagen Amarok pick up a lot of that too, given the two cars will share a lot of their bones. So it's a really interesting time. And I guess, you know, we've made a huge song and dance about the Isuzu D-Max in the last 12 months or so, because that's been a really big change for the ute segment. But what we've seen coming out of these Ford prototypes and, you know, some of the rumors going around the industry, it's going to be an even bigger jump again in the next 12 months.
Fantastic. Good timing for Ford as well. We're going to talk about more news right now. And we'll start with you, Moco. Suzuki Australia have seemed to have come up with a way of getting around the semiconductor shortage.
Yeah, so as we know, car manufacturers around the world are, you know, grinding their factories to a halt because those little tiny computer chips that run all the infotainment systems and active safety systems and various other, you know, mechanical electrical systems on board, they're in short supply. You know, tech companies like Samsung and Apple have taken them all up. Car manufacturers during COVID postponed orders and can't, you know, make up for lost time now. It's a disaster. But Suzuki's come up with a pretty clever way of going, right, we can get more cars on the ground, and that involves bringing them out of the Japanese and the European factories where they source Vitara from with no head units whatsoever, because they were told by supplier Bosch back in April that there's not going to be any head units available because we don't have any chips to put in them, and that was going to have this trickle-down effect where customers wouldn't be getting their cars. So Suzuki Australia Management, a guy named Michael Pachoto, who I spoke with this week, reached out to a company that is involved in the distribution of head units, and they actually crafted a new design head unit OEM-specific to Suzuki to fit at the AutoNexus distribution centres in Australia before they go out to dealers. And the company is estimating that about 3,500 to 4,000 extra cars will make it to Australian shores before the end of Japanese financial year, March 31 next year, that is, that otherwise wouldn't have if they hadn't come up with this solution. So that's 4,000 Suzuki Swift and Vitara and Ignis buyers who will get a car that they would not have been able to get if this policy hadn't been put in place. It's the first time Suzuki's done this anywhere in the world. So I thought it was quite a cool example. And obviously it doesn't apply to every manufacturer because let's be honest, Suzuki's touchscreens are pretty basic and they're pretty easy to replace. And obviously, you couldn't do this with a Mercedes-Benz, for instance. The MBUX system is a whole different ballgame. But I think it shows that if you think a bit outside the box and you're capable of pivoting, you can get around these supply issues if you've got a supportive corporate environment overseas, which is what Suzuki Australia has. So I'd be keeping an eye out for some other manufacturers to maybe follow suit if this, you know, policy from Suzuki goes well.
All right. And the next story, Joe, where the 2022 Lexus LX has been unveiled and it's coming to Australia.
Yes. So, you know, we've made a big song and dance about Land Cruiser 300 series over the last, I don't even know how long, it's probably been months at this point. I don't know what month or day it is at the moment, but Lexus has revealed the all-new LX, which is, as it always has been, a more luxurious version of the Land Cruiser. So it doesn't look very different from the old one. The front is, you know, very, very similar. The main difference in terms of design is more out back. They've got this new back signature and one-piece tailgate with LED light strip connecting those L-shaped taillights, which is pretty consistent amongst the Lexus range at the moment. And then they've also overhauled the interior. So while the exterior proportions and some of the look might look a little bit similar to a Land Cruiser, the interior is very, very bespoke. It's got this dual screen infotainment setup. It's got a new four-seat executive VIP style configuration option. There's quilted leather, Lexus badging everywhere, and it's obviously a little step up to go against the likes of, you know, the Range Rover and all sorts of other luxury European cars. In terms of engines, it's got the same two engine options globally as the Land Cruiser. So we've got that 3.3 litre twin turbo V6 diesel, as well as a 3.5 litre twin turbo V6. So the V6 petrol will be called LX600, and then the diesel will be called LX500D. And they make the same outputs as the Land Cruiser. So the petrol makes 305 kilowatts and 650 newton metres, while the diesel makes 227 kilowatts and 700 newton meters, and they both drive all four wheels via a 10-speed automatic. What we don't know yet is what the rumored hybrid version will be called or what it's actually going to run. So we've run a few stories now speculating that the LX, let's call it the 750H, or, you know, the whatever label they want to call it in the industry at the moment, but it'll run the same hybrid setup that was released in the new Toyota Tundra in the US. So that basically takes that 3.5 litre twin turbo V6 and adds some hybrid stuff to it, making it more powerful but also more efficient. We're expecting that to be revealed for the Land Cruiser in the coming year or so, because they've basically indicated that a hybrid will eventually come to market, and we assume that Lexus will do the same. So it looks really, really cool, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, the two of you, because I guess one thing that Lexus hasn't always done historically is differentiate cars like the LX from the Toyota donor cars. There are some models where, you know, you've got your IS and GS that sort of differentiate themselves enough. And in Australia, they don't have a Toyota equivalent, whereas the LX in some cases has been a bit too much like a tarted up Land Cruiser. So what are your thoughts on the design and the tech available?
I mean, it's got the biggest grill I've ever seen, which, you know, saying from Lexus is something, because that's not a company that does, you know, quiet grills. By and large, though, I think the rear is much more resolved, actually, than the Land Cruisers. The side profile looks great. It's got a slightly different window line at the sort of past the C-pillar there. Otherwise, very, very similar. But look, it's so imposing. And inside, like you say, Wongy, it's so much more differentiated inside. In contrast to the old one, I think the old one was sort of, it was very much a tarted up Land Cruiser, whereas this one looks like it kind of has a bit of its own sort of thing going on. What do you reckon, Mandy?
I reckon those the last photo on the story at the site, or second last one, with those giant, are they 22-inch wheels? I think.
At least.
Because they look massive, but it looks boss at the same time. It doesn't. You cannot see a Toyota in that photo there. But I agree that grill. Wow. Okay. Moco, this is incredible news. It seems like the Hyundai Ioniq 5 has been extremely popular that you can't really buy one now.
Yeah, it's a perfect storm of rampant demand and utterly patently inadequate supply. And a bit of a, you know, egg on face tech snafu while we're at it. So basically the new Ioniq 5 is the company's first EMP-based ground-up, you know, from the get-go skateboard-based electric car, the twin under the skin to Kia's EV6 and Genesis GV60. It looks awesome. It harks to the Pony of the late 70s, I believe. So it sort of harks back to Hyundai's origins and looks like nothing else on the road. Now, the company took about 13,000 expressions of interest before launch and realized that, oh, crap, we're not going to come close to supplying the demand. So rather than giving them to dealers or wholesale them to dealers, it decided to sell them online at a fixed price, which is the first time it's done that. It's similar to what it does with its Genesis products. But even that wasn't enough, because all 240 were spoken for within 2 hours. The site that you were buying them off crashed numerous times, and I've had people reach out to our news email quite a lot this week and on our social channels this week telling us that they tried to buy one and couldn't buy one. There's another tranche of 160 being released at the beginning of next year, so hopefully the people that missed out can get one then. But it's quite obvious that the supply is not even close to what the demand for this vehicle is. And, you know, Hyundai Australia, it's kind of a victim in this too, because it gets what it's given. It's not like it can go back to the Korean factory and say, no, damn it, give us 10,000 cars. It doesn't work that way. And, you know, this is a car that's sort of a victim of its own success. So I don't know, you could read into it positively or negatively, but at the end of the day, there are a lot of pretty annoyed customers that were desperately trying to give Hyundai $75,000 who can't. So make it that what you will.
I just found that story really interesting. And I think that even if it's a pain in the proverbial for, you know, consumers that were trying to get their hands on one, I think that maybe we'll send a message to Global saying we need more cars and we maybe need to focus more on electrified product, because, you know, it's not just Hyundai. Historically, we've seen across the board in, you know, I've been covering automotive news for a while now, and the consistent theme is that there's no demand or there's no legislation that supports it. People aren't going to buy them. Whereas now we're seeing that so many people are buying Teslas, so many people want an Ioniq 5, so many people want all these electrified vehicles that are available globally. So hopefully we're going to see the tables turn a little bit, and maybe with a little bit more government-based incentive, we might actually see more of this stuff land in showrooms and in people's driveways. So I guess it's only a good sign, and maybe Kia and Genesis will be sort of licking their lips now thinking, okay, well, maybe people can't get an Ioniq. Maybe they'll come to our showroom and buy our thing, because it's essentially the same car anyway.
Yeah, if I ever hear a pundit ever, ever, ever again say that Australians don't want electric cars, I'll just flick him a link to our Ioniq 5 coverage, because there is a perfect example of the fact that Australians, in fact, do want electric cars. They just don't have the bloody choice that they deserve. Yeah. And credit to Hyundai for launching a cool product. Hyundai Australia, that is. Maybe not so much credit to Hyundai globally for undercooking the factory output so much. Let's hope they get a wriggle on, huh?
Couldn't agree more. Can't wait to see that on the road. Now, J-Wo, there's going to be a certain model that we won't see on Australian roads anymore, and that is the standard Ford Focus. But thankfully, the ST is going to be staying.
Yes. So just today at the time of recording, which is probably a few days ahead of the publishing time of the podcast, but Ford Europe revealed the updated Focus range. And so Ford Australia also announced that it will be bringing in the updated ST next year. If you head to the carexpert.com.au story, you'll see that it's very green and it's very aggressive looking. It looks like a very, very angry little frog, sort of like a enlarged version of the Fiesta that was released a couple of months ago. So clearly Ford has gone and overhauled all of its European product. Unfortunately, the confirmation of the new ST coincides with the confirmation that we'll no longer be getting the standard Focus range in Australia as of next year. They're expecting the ST to arrive in the second quarter of 2022. So we'll obviously see just them rely on remaining stock, if there's any. Because if you go to VFACTS, you'll see that there hasn't been a lot of Focuses sold in the last year or so. But, you know, it was once one of the top-selling small cars in Australia. It's gone from, you know, high sales in the teens maybe a decade or so ago, and then after their little power shift fiasco, it's dropping down into, you know, the hundreds a year, if not less than that. So it's a real shame. My brother actually recently bought a current generation Focus as a used car, but he loves it so much, and I've driven it a couple of times, and fundamentally it's been a great car. I know, Mocha, you've driven them at length. I've reviewed a couple now and really enjoyed it, and I just feel like it was never given the chance by not just Ford Australia, but also by consumers, because people have started flocking to SUVs and other brands now that are maybe a little bit more competitive on price or a little bit more flashy on style. Because, yeah, in Europe, this car is super popular, and, you know, the normal models in Europe now get like mild hybrid tech, and the ST will pick up the cool new stuff like the Pixel LED headlights and the new Sync 4 infotainment, which has like some ridiculously large screen. It's like 13 inches or something. So we'll see, you know, some of that in the very highly specced ST and STX next year. But if you want to get that stuff in maybe a 30 to 35 grand non-performance one, which is still what a lot of people buy, even though this normal small car segment's down quite a bit, it's a shame that we're just losing a very long-running nameplate that still resonates with a lot of people, I feel. It's just clearly they don't feel like they can make an impact with it anymore.
Yeah, Var later, the cheapest German car that you could buy, because it was indeed sourced from Germany. Mm-hmm. Ford has historically in Australia been terrible at selling the majority of its cars, actually. It used to be the Falcon company. Now it's the Ranger company with a few Mustangs thrown in. Doesn't do very well selling a lot of its other vehicles. Admittedly, it's doing a better job with Puma. But, you know, there are cars like this where you just look at it and you go, how are you not selling more of them? Because it's a great competitive vehicle. And, you know, it's not as if the Corolla, Mazda 3 and Golf aren't popular anymore. Yes, small car sales are down, but they haven't collapsed. It's still a major segment, 12 or 13% of the market. So Ford's failure in this space continues to be an issue. And as good as it is that the ST stuck around, and that's awesome, it does feel like a loss. Not everybody wants an Escape, you know, and it's a good car that probably didn't get the run it deserved.
My sister used to have a 2005 blue Focus. It was a manual, and she couldn't kill the thing. The paint was coming off, the interior was falling off, but it just kept driving and driving.
She didn't
have
a power shift then one, huh?
She didn't, no. Thankfully, it's incredible.
Well, I just remember how popular they were during that noughties period. That first and second generation did so well, and then it was just that transmission thing that must have mucked it up for everybody else, because I think most of us would know somebody or have owned a Focus ourselves at some point, because, you know, that time when everyone was flocking to small cars, when the Mazda 3 was the top selling vehicle in Australia, the Focus wasn't far behind. And so it's just a shame.
CarExpert.com.au, hit the news link if you would like to know more. This would have to be one of the more interesting track test comparisons our performance editor Chris Atko Atkinson has ever done. It's between the Ford Mustang Mach-1 and the Mustang GT. Hello, Atko.
Hi, how are you?
Very good. I'd be keen to find out what your experience has been in the past with Mustangs.
It was pretty limited up until that day, actually. I think I was trying to remember when I was writing the story, and I remember I caught a late night flight from Phoenix to, um, I I think I was going to Washington, D.C. I was trying to get to a meeting in Philadelphia randomly, and the only car in the lot, it was just crazy, was either a Mustang convertible or a like a 20-seater bus. So, so I had to
have the bus call.
I went with the bus, yes. Wow. See if I could do some Uber driving on the way. But, yeah, and it was – and I drove – it's like a two-hour drive up the freeway. It was pouring rain in this convertible Mustang. So – and then literally the next morning I had a meeting, dropped it at Philly Airport and flew back to Phoenix. So it was like literally one dark night in America in the rain was my experience. And it was torrential rain. So I was like – I didn't have the best memories, but it was good to get these cars on the track, that's for sure.
Absolutely. So what exactly is the difference between these two Mustang models?
Firstly, I thought there wasn't going to be much difference. I didn't expect a lot going to the track. And even on paper, it didn't really seem to add up to a lot. There was a slight power advantage, different gearbox, but when you dig a little deeper, there's geometry changes, there's suspension changes. The Mark One had the MagnaRide suspension, which you can option on the GT as well, but there was more than that. Like there was the geometry changes they'd gone for. It almost, when I hopped in it and went on the track, it felt like two completely different cars. Like, it was ridiculous. Yeah. And it's not like the GT was bad saying that. Like, it did a good time and did a lot of things well. But the Mark One was, like, almost a completely different experience when you hopped in it. And I expected them to be relatively similar. But, like, every aspect, the engine, the gearbox was different. And then the balance and the support and how it reacted on the track was completely different. The only thing that I'd say that was similar was the rear differential, which was maybe a letdown on the car. It actually worked quite well when it was flowing, but when you try to ask a bit more of it and get some consistent locking, it was in and out of locking phases and not really consistent. So that was probably the only similar thing. Obviously, they look similar. Interiors are very similar. But the actual experience of driving them is like polar opposites.
Wow. Do they even sound different as well?
It's actually funny. When I'm on the track and I've got my helmet on, I've got a rally-style helmet, I've got inbuilt headphones, I can barely hear the cars. So, like, it's funny, like, everyone's sort of, like, talking about the sound of the cars. And I'm like, oh, you can hear the engine, you can hear the revs, but it's not like you experience the full sound. I think they sound very similar. Just how I can't remember, was it 2 kilowatts or 4 kilowatts different in power? Like, it was nothing. And the experience of the rev range was completely different. So how the engine revved out, like, it just changed the car completely. And the gear ratios played like some role in that, because the gear ratios in the Mark One are a little bit tighter in the mid range. So you're shifting actually an extra gear on the straight. But
Manual and auto, Adco, sorry?
They were both manuals. So
we did
all manuals. It just revved out. It just kept revving. So it's funny how quite often you'll look on paper at a number and it goes, oh, yeah, they should be quite similar. And the way the engine actually performs is completely different to two identical numbers on paper, because a power curve is a completely different thing to a peak power number. And when we're racing, like, we look at the whole picture of the engine. We don't look at a peak number as an ideal. Like, quite often you'll have an engine with crazy peak power, but it's undrivable. So you can't use it, and it's like so late in the power curve that it's wasted. So you, an engine that's – and I've talked about a lot in some of the comparisons – is how they blend the torque curve and power curves and how they overlap. And you'll see cars where it's just shifted more to peak power and you'll miss a bit of torque, and there's this middle section where they just miss out on performance, even though it looks great on paper. And it sort of loses the momentum on the track or even on performance. And you can see the manufacturers I just actually drove the i30N, the updated model, yesterday. And they worked on that, and I sort of complained about it in my first test on that car. And they've definitely worked on it, and the overlap between the torque and power is much nicer. And then it feels like a just so much more, even though on paper it's not a lot more. And I think that's what happened here with the Mark One. They just broadened everything and stretched it out and let it rev a bit freer, and it was just so much more reactive and responsive on the track.
Hmm. Now, these two Mustangs weren't the only ones you drove on the track, were they, Atco?
No, we had the High Performance, which I kept getting confused with the name. So the is it 2.4?
2.3,
yeah, litre, four-cylinder. And we had it there, and we were sort of like, well, do we do a three-part test or a two-part test on the day? We were sort of running out of time, so we focused on the two, but I did get on track with the High Performance. And there were some bets going around that maybe it could match the V8s and so on, but it wasn't even close. But interestingly, the balance of it was really nice because the less weight at the front. So it actually handled quite well, but just the other two just ate it up on the straights. Like, there was actually quite a big power difference. And I said this in the story, it's like not always you see such a nice flow of price into performance, and I think Ford have done that very well. Like, it really staggers up from the sort of 50 grand into the mid 60s all the way to the 80, and you get a big chunk of performance improvement every step along the way, which is quite cool.
How did they handle the corners differently?
I didn't do many laps in the High Performance, but I remember being a lot lighter in the front end, a lot freer, and quite well balanced. Similar suspension wise to the GT, like a little bit of roll. They're quite soft, those two cars. So you had quite a lot of body movement. But a thing body movement or softer suspension gives you is traction. So the GT and the High Performance had great traction. So actually increased traction over the Mark One, which is a interesting, because you watch people, they'll go to tracks and they'll make the cars as stiff as possible, but they give away traction. So they think they're actually like making the car faster, which in certain areas of the corner they are, but they're in other ways they're giving it away. So you always see these sort of overlaps between how stiff you want the car and whether you want traction or not. So the GT was unreal off the corners because it was so soft. So it sort of squatted and the suspension could move and keep the wheels on the ground. And the front turn in for a quite heavy, big engine up the front, the front grip in it was unreal as well. Like, so once you got the nose down and that, the GT actually turned slightly better than the Mark One because of that grip. Where the Mark One was more in the direction of a race car where it was very stable and planted, but in the slower speed corners, you actually lost a bit of grip as a result of that added stiffness. And I've been trying to think about it a lot with all these adjustable dampers that everyone's doing and trying to understand the best way to do it, because I don't think they're all quite getting it right and there's some compromises to it. And the more I drive more cars on track, and I got to drive two Lamborghinis yesterday, both one with non-adjustable dampers and the other one with adjustable dampers. And you can see that the ones that are focused going, okay, we're going to make one damper that works well, it works really well. And when they make these adjustable ones, they're overlapping. There's compromises along the way. I feel like this could go on forever, my thoughts about this, because it's evolving all the time, because I hop on track and it's not always the stiffest setting that's the fastest setting, and even on the Porsche day, I'd love to go back and do some more times in the GD2 RS and 3 RSs as well, because I think I can go a bit quicker in those now I understand. And I spoke to the Porsche instructors and they said they actually go faster in the slightly softer setting. And
isn't that interesting?
And I've noticed that with a lot of cars now. I-30N yesterday went quicker in the slightly softer setting. The only car that I haven't gone slower than is the Mustang with the MagnaRide. So that actually works really well. But nearly every other car, when they try, and it's not artificially, but they're basically stiffening the whole damper curve. It's like areas you want to be soft for traction and things, then then miss out. So you really struggle.
So there was a bit of a snafu, which I'm sure you heard about, ATCO, earlier this year with Ford Australia printing brochures that said that the Mustang Mark 1 had some features that it didn't have. One of those was that it had the 373:1 torsion differential that's available on US market models. We've missed out on that. It uses internal gears instead of clutch packs. Do you think that I know you haven't driven it, but do you think that potentially could elevate the Mark 1 driving experience? And 100%. Do you think it's a there's also an optional handling package available in the US, which adds Michelin Pilot Sport Cup 2 tires, adjustable top strut mounts, front splitter, et cetera, et cetera. So what do you think? If you were spending the money on Mark 1, would you love to have the option of that?
Well, interestingly, the differential that is in the GT, which obviously I realized as, and I didn't actually know that when I drove them, I thought they were slightly different, and I drove them and I go, they just feel exactly the same. And I think on the track, cause I had traction. So differentials don't matter as much when you've got grip. So in racing world, we'll run as soft a differential as we can get away with. If we've got the grip, the differential saves you when you have slip. If you've got grip, you don't have slip, so you don't need such a strong differential. And the freer you can run your differential, the faster you can usually go through the corner. So there's some very clever technology in the differential world that I've experienced in rally, and they're basically mechanical differentials that act like active differentials, and they create that negative preload, so they can open. And they can adjust the whole torque curve of the differential, and they can open and become completely free on entry, which is amazing. That hasn't made it into many cars. I know some Porsches in racing run a similar differential. I don't think the actual GT3 RSs do have them, but they may. I could be wrong there. But there's stuff like that going on. So what the differential that was in the car actually felt very free. So when I had traction and I wasn't trying to overdrive it, it worked really well. And sometimes when you go some of these more aggressive differentials that have a constant preload, say, so there's a minimum force there, then you're always fighting against that minimum force. So not necessarily in that situation where you're looking for a perfect corner, is this other differential going to be better? But when you're asking for more, say trying to slide the car a bit and be a bit more aggressive, that's when those consistencies will come into play and you'll go, okay, now it's working better, because you'll be able to catch the slip and maintain the control over across the axles, where the differentials that are in the car now couldn't do that. So it would let it spin, then it would catch it, then it would let it spin, and that's just the car's going like this in the corner as you're trying to drift it. So that's the difference. The rest of the pack, I can't say much about the aero, whether it's going to do too much, but the Cup 2 tyres are awesome. So to be fair, they're probably the 4S's at the moment, and the Cup 2s are my two favourite that I've tested on this year. And especially the 4S's do really well on a car that's not hard on tyres as well. As soon as they put too much energy into the tire and heat them up, then they drop off, where the Cup 2s actually like that. They like a bit of energy into them to build up to speed. I think I said in the story that the Mark 1 actually made it a bit harder for the tires because it's stiffer. So you're putting more energy in the tire, you're getting a bit more slip. And then I couldn't do as consistent lap times because that energy going into the tire. So the Cup 2 would definitely suit more on the Mark 1.
Yeah, interesting. I'm learning so much here.
Yeah, it's like an oracle.
it's awesome. I suppose we probably should say which one won, which was the quickest.
It was pretty clear, and I didn't expect it to be such a gap. I think they both did great times. I think it was 59.99 for the GT, and I'm going to have to check the car expert, but it was
that's
website.
All right.
It was 58.5 or 58.4.
58.48.
And a half seconds in under 1.5 kilometers. So it's, I think it's 1.2 kilometer track. So that for me was actually, that's quite a big difference. That's and in the 58s, you start to get some competitive cars in there. There's the A45 AMG. And I know they're quite different cars, but that's a really quick car and power to weight and things like that. So for the Mustang Mark 1 to be on that sort of pace is very impressive. And the next second up, you're starting to get to BMW M8, BMW 550i.
Wow.
There's some good cars up there that double, triple in price and the rest. Looking at value for performance money, that Mark 1 is actually one of the best on the leaderboards, I would say. And you put Cup 2 tyres on it, it's going definitely up another second. So it's a pretty competitive package at that price. Yeah, pretty much the top four cars at the moment are all on Cup 2s, basically. And
I think it might be a next track test, Echo. Put the Cup 2s on it and see what happens.
Yeah. I'd actually really like to do just a back-to-back tyre test and see across the range. And you really notice it with the tyres that aren't track-focused. It's really a one-lap shot you've got to get a time. And as soon as some heat gets into the tyre, they just drop away. And I was annoyed yesterday. I was in the I-30N. I had a great lap going, like as good as I could do through turn one and two, and then three and four was okay, and then turn five I missed the breaking point, and I still did the fastest lap, but I knew I blew it, and I did a better lap after that, but that lap with cold tyres would have been awesome, and it's always a challenge to try and get the most out of them. Where with Cup twos you can definitely do the fastest lap on any of the laps you're out there.
Yeah, that's so, so cool. We could talk about this all day. Yeah. If you haven't seen the video and the story, it is live at carexpert.com.au. Chris Atkinson, it's always been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Yeah, great to see you all and hopefully catch you again soon.
Toyota's new flagship model, the Land Cruiser 300, has finally been driven by Car Expert, and the man of the people, Tony Crawford, has driven it. Hello, Crawf.
Some would argue that, Mandy.
I don't know about that.
I like to think I'm a man. I came up through the ranks through, you know, a $500 shitbox Cortina, and then... Then there was an even worse shitbox, which was a used Passat. I don't even know what you call this car, but it was the ugliest Volkswagen I think they've ever made.
All right, we better start talking about the car we really want to hear about, which is the Land Cruiser 300.
Yeah, wow.
How big is this model for Toyota going to be?
It's going to be huge. Like if it wasn't huge before, which we all know it was, you know, this is their solid. This thing sells like hotcakes year round, day round. You know, like I don't know how many people, but 10 million were sold, I think, up to 2019. So that gives you an indication of how successful this single model is. And this one, I mean, I've got to say, I would never have considered myself a Land Cruiser kind of guy. I always, you know, love what Land Rover were doing with Range Rovers and Range Rover Sport and all that. But I tell you what, my first glimpse of this car inside, and I thought, wow, this just knocks you on your feet. This is game changing for them. Not that they needed it, right? Because what this car has heralded has been the demise of the V8 diesel, the 4.5 litre V8 diesel, and now we've got a replaced across the entire range, a 3.3 litre twin turbo diesel, which pumps out a cool 227 kilowatts and 700 newton metres. And that's 50 more torques and 27 kilowatts more than the outgoing V8. And I tell you what, I had to pull over to the side of the road because I was desperately trying to post a video on the way down to the off-road. Kind of a walk around, and it wasn't working for me, and I pulled over to the side of the freeway on the Hume and was trying to get this freaking thing to work, and I had to gun it to get back on the freeway, and this thing just up and went. And I tell you what, it's the smoothest diesel, and this is like I'm talking Euros as well. This thing married to a new 10-speed auto torque converter transmission is a work of art, if I can say that, because I was shocked at how refined and how this thing shifted gears so quickly, and it shifts like 28% faster than the previous six-speed, I think. Everywhere you look in this car, it's a clean sheet design, guys. And while it shares some proportions, because it's about anywhere from 4.9 to 5.010 meters long, but it's up to 160 kilos lighter because they've used aluminium for the roof, for the bonnet, for the doors, and the tailgate. So, you know, 160 kilos is quite a lot of weight off this thing. So I think it weighs around 2460, which is still heavier, right? You're never going to get away from a car this big weighing that kind of, you know, tipping the scales at that kind of those kind of weights. But it's stiffer. The rigidity is up by about, you know, 23% or whatever. But you can feel that from the moment you tip into a corner.
So you talk about the weight cuts, Crawf, and the secret weapon there is, of course, the TNGAF platform underneath it. So it utilizes a new body-on-frame platform, so don't panic, it's not some fancy monocoque SUV. No. It still remains a body-on-frame ladder chassis. But huge revisions to that car. And one of the things that interested me most, Crawf, Australia is just about the key market for Land Cruisers worldwide, one of the biggest markets. The development program on this car goes back to 2014, which tells you how long Toyota works on this halo vehicle. And it claims that it's done more Australian suspension work than any iteration of Land Cruiser that comes before it.
Yeah.
So with that being the case, with the entirely overhauled suspension, the stiffer platform and more localization work, does it feel even more capable and composed in, you know, your typical Aussie crappy country roads than the old one did? Because the old one ate up the miles pretty bloody well.
Well, look, let me preface that by saying I didn't get that much seat time in the previous model apart from the occasional press hire or press loan. But I was mighty impressed, even with the Sahara. Now, let me preface this by saying that the Sahara the standard Sahara, and I'll add to this in a minute, that doesn't get adaptive suspension. So the only two model variants that get adaptive suspension are in fact the two new model variants called the Sahara ZX and the GR Sport. So they're two variants that have been added to the carryover range, which was GX, GXL, VX, and Sahara. So I drove the GR Sport back home, the 230Ks, and I was shattered in terms of, not shattered, that's the wrong word, I was flabbergasted in terms of how good this thing was. And what the GR Sport gives you, I know I'm going all over the shop here, but the GR Sport gets three diff locks. So every Land Cruiser gets a center differential, but the GR Sport gets both front and rear diff locks and wait for it, disconnecting active sway bars. And they're lockable on the road, and without having to press any buttons, it just senses what's underfoot and locks those sway bars. And off-road, it disconnects those sway bars, much like what the Wrangler Rubicon does. And off-road, I was only in the VX off-road, and I got to say, it was just, they said it was a moderate trail, and then we went to a hard trail. I found the stuff all too easy for this thing, and mostly you could do it in high range. That's the other bizarre thing. I mean, I don't think we actually needed to go into low range to get through any of these steep ravines or big chunky ruts. And rock crawling that we did up some fairly narrow ravines. It was all too easy for this car, and I'm desperate to get the GR Sport in some proper, really hardcore stuff up near Lithgow maybe, where it's pretty treacherous up there sometimes in the rain. And I'm really, really desperate to do that. I've done a lot of off-roading in my time. I learned to drive on a Willys Jeep, so I'm pretty familiar with it. I do like it. But then coming back home, in the GR Sport, I put it into Sport S Plus. So there's five different drive modes in the ZX and in the Sahara ZX and the GR Sport, and right up to Sport S Plus. And I had some guy tailgating me basically on an undulating B road, and I thought, oh, okay, I'll just give it a bit here. And so I tucked it into a right hand corner. Really hard, just absolutely planted this thing. And this thing, the body roll just didn't exist as it does in the standard Sahara and even the VX. You get a bit of body roll, but it's very well controlled because of the extra rigidity of the of that platform that what did you call it, Mocha? The TPNG?
TNGA. Yes, my friend. To use a technical piece of jargon, not that it means anything to the average car buyer.
It doesn't. I did cover it in my review. You can read all about it on carexpert.com.au. I did cover that. And, yes, that platform is sensational. Look, I can't, you know, I get criticized a lot in my reviews for not picking holes apart. But I'm sorry, guys, but... You know, no car is perfect these days, not even the Land Cruiser 300. But I tell you what, it's mighty close because I can't find any holes other than the fake wood grain, the fake wood that's on the upper echelon of models here. Looks a bit, I mean, it kind of feels real, but I know it's not. But I can't find any holes in this thing.
Right. So there is a big problem with this car, which is supply. So the company's got 500 of them. On the ground in dealers for demos, and that is it until probably Christmas.
They have got tens of... I heard 6 months, yeah.
At least 6 months wait, probably more like 9 to 12 when demand really kicks in.
Oh,
and as good as the car is, that is a massive amount of time to have to wait.
I think it is, Moko, but, I mean, you know Toyota Land Cruiser fans are absolute diehards and... You know, if people like me that probably wouldn't have considered buying a Land Cruiser over a Euro make model, I would now very, very strongly look towards probably the VX or the GR Sport. And I was just about to say, the way this GR Sport handled some fairly, at a good clip, some fairly undulating corners and bends, I was so impressed. Not only that, the ride comfort off-road in the VX was akin to what I've felt in a Range Rover. This is a massive statement, dudes, but and everyone knows I'm a big fan of Land Rover, but this car was just as comfortable in a VX, which doesn't have the adaptive suspension, mind, was just as comfortable off-road, straddling these ruts and these rock crawls as it would be in a Range Rover. And I'm very serious when I say that. You know, I don't want to hand over these compliments lightly. You know, when I'm talking Range Rover versus Land Cruiser, but the fact is, this car rides amazingly well off road. And like I said, the moderate to hard trails they supposedly put us on seemed all too easy for this vehicle. I don't know what more to say. The interior is just an amazing collection of buttons and stuff that have all been grouped together in proper segments so that everything is so intuitive. I mean, normally I struggle and fiddle around with radar cruise and getting my speeds right and actually turning it on sometimes is more difficult than people can believe. But this thing, you get in, it's right there on the right-hand side of the steering wheel. Normally it's on the left of most makes and models, but this is on the right, and it's absolutely intuitive from the minute, from the get-go. And that's everything from the start button, which protrudes at the top, not hidden by a steering wheel, which some SUVs are. You can never find them. This one is – they must have thought about this on that big drive they did called the Five Continent Drive, which Australia is part of, and they spoke to many, many owners of Land Rover 200 series, and they got all the, you know, warts and all of what people thought of this vehicle and how to improve it. As Moko just said, they started in 2014 and prototypes arrived in 2015, and all the information that came from the owners and of the 200 series has obviously been put back into the engineers' scope of works, and they have done the improvements to make this vehicle something that even I would consider and no doubt many other not previous Land Cruiser owners will be considering this vehicle when they read the reviews, because I'm betting most of the reviews are going to be 99.9% positive with this vehicle, because I don't know how you're going to pick holes in this vehicle other than what Moko said, the wait time. But I think people will hang around for this car and keep their old car a little bit longer. And don't forget, there is a pricing increase. So it's up to $10,000 more than the previous 200 series in the carryover models, right? And that's a fair bit of money. But I would counter that, and I'm not trying to be kind to them. It is a lot more money, 10 grand, but I think you're getting a lot more car for your money too. So, Mandy, in a nutshell, this is a game changer even for diehard Land Cruiser owners. And if you want one, as Moko said, get your name down now because you're probably going to be waiting, as he said, 9 to 12 months even. This is a special vehicle. They've really done their homework, and I think they've delivered a proper cracking car, cracking engine, cracking everything.
All right, that sounds like a really good wrap. You can have a look at the review now live at Car Expert. Tony Crawford, thank you.
Thanks, guys.
All righty, Mike Costello and James Wong, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mandy.
Pleasure, guys.